Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books and Biography, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Mark Clovis, your host for the channel. Today I'm talking with Andrew Roberts about his new biography of Winston Churchill entitled Churchill, Walking with Destiny. Andrew, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, indeed, Mark. It's very nice to be on it.
And it's very nice to have an opportunity to speak to a historian of your stature.
Well, that's very kind of you.
I was wondering if you could start us off by telling us something about yourself.
Well, I've been a historian now for 30 years. I left Cambridge University where I read history in order to go into the city and be a banker, and discovered fairly soon that I was functionally innumerate and completely useless at my job, and therefore I chucked it and did the thing that I'd always loved the most, which was the world of history. And I have to say, although sometimes in life you do have things you regret, that's a decision I haven't regretted for one second.
The choice of Churchill is a fascinating one, given the wealth of scholarship that is out there about him. And
yes,
go ahead.
You can say that again. There are 1,009 books on Churchill, so there is something slightly hubristic in bringing out a 1,010th. But the fact is that in the last 10 years, there's been the most extraordinary cornucopia of new sources about Churchill. I was very fortunate that Her Majesty the Queen allowed me to be the first Churchill biographer to use her father's diaries, and these have proved invaluable. There are also, we might go on and talk about those in a little bit later, but there's also been 41 sets of new papers that have been deposited at Churchill College Archives in Cambridge University by people who worked with Churchill and were close to him, including the 1940 diary of his daughter, Mary Soames. There's the diaries of the Soviet ambassador that have become available in the last 10 years, Ivan Maisky, who's ambassador to London from 1932 to 43. The verbal actual accounts of the War Cabinet minutes, which I discovered 6 years ago, and many other of those kind of level. The Churchill family have been very generous in allowing me to use family papers that haven't been seen by other historians as well. So I've been tremendously fortunate that in the last 10 years or so, there's been an avalanche of new sources, which means that there's something on pretty much every page of this biography that has never appeared in a Churchill biography before.
That makes for definitely a fresh look at Churchill. In what ways did you find that it changed your understanding in particular of Churchill as a person and as a historical figure?
Well, to go back to the diaries of King George VI, which I used, I was very surprised by the level of frustration, irritation, really, that Winston Churchill had, which he couldn't express to anyone apart from the king. He couldn't say it in public, but he had with the Roosevelt administration. He saw the Second World War very much as a struggle between good and evil, civilization versus barbarism, and fascism versus democracy. And so he couldn't see why the American people weren't, and more importantly, their political leaders, weren't getting more involved more heavily than they were in that period between the outbreak of the war in September 1939 and Hitler declaring war on America on the 11th of December 1941. I wonder if I could just say a little bit more about these diaries. They're very important, and it's quite extraordinary, really, the insight that they give, because the King had lunch with Winston Churchill every Tuesday of the Second World War. Churchill would go to Buckingham Palace, have an audience, they'd have lunch, and they'd serve themselves from the sideboard because the things they were discussing were so secret. You couldn't have anybody else there. He told the King about the ultra secret, about the nuclear secrets, where the Allies were going to attack and when. He told the king about ministers and generals who he was going to hire and fire, sometimes weeks before he actually did. And so these two men trusted each other greatly. And rather wonderfully, the king then wrote down everything that Churchill said in the meetings. So we have this insight into the hopes and fears, the aperçus and jokes of Winston Churchill for every Tuesday of the Second World War.
It's interesting that you mentioned the intelligence, because lately there's been a lot of work done about the history of intelligence. Christopher Andrews has been doing some fascinating work. And one of the points that has come out from it is that it's an aspect of the war that Churchill himself was never able to address publicly prior to his passing in 1965. He was never able to acknowledge the role that it played in terms of his own history of the Second World War. And that's something that I was thinking about as I was reading your book, about a dimension of it that you were able to introduce. And it's fascinating to consider that he was able, even in spite of this deeply held secrecy about it, to talk to the king about it on a weekly basis.
That's right. Yes, exactly. It really was a sign of how much he trusted the king. Of course, he knew that the king was one of the few people in public life who wasn't after his job, which I suppose helped slightly. But there was no reason why they should necessarily have got on so well, because if you remember, only 4 years earlier, Winston Churchill had supported Edward VIII, the king's elder brother, during the abdication crisis, which left the king very much doubting Churchill's judgment. In fact, he told the Prime Minister of Canada that he wouldn't appoint Winston Churchill to the government unless there were a world war, which of course there was. So he was lucky in that respect. And also Churchill had doubt the King's judgment, because he had been a very strong supporter. The King had been a very strong supporter of Neville Chamberlain's policy of appeasement. So they might not have got on. But in fact, they did, and they got on very quickly. And certainly by the time of the fall of France and the Battle of Britain, and definitely by the Blitz, the King was calling Churchill by his Christian name, calling him Winston, which he didn't do for any of the other prime ministers that he had. And in these diaries, he actually refers to Churchill as his friend.
It sounds like, given your description, that for Churchill, the King was more than just his sovereign. He could also serve as this very unique, almost psychological counselor that he could unburden himself to in a way that he could
king,
with virtually nobody else.
The King Emperor's shrink. Yes, exactly. There is an element to that, definitely, because he was the person who he could tell everything to, knowing that he could trust him implicitly, knowing that he had the best interests of the nation at heart, knowing that he was apolitical, and knowing that, you know, he knew all of the people that they were discussing. The King had met the President of France. He had met the President of Roosevelt. He'd met the Prime Minister of Canada, and of course all the major British politicians. So it was, and soldiers. So it was, in that sense, an important relationship, and a rather revelatory one, especially when we now have the opportunity to read his diaries.
Now, it's important to keep in perspective the fact that the diaries are just one addition to what is a very substantial biography. And I was wondering if we could go back a bit and talk a bit about Winston Churchill's early life. What do you think that you covered in your early chapters about his youth, his early years in politics, that you feel warrants attention or that might have been overlooked by previous biographers?
I think his relationship with his father was an extraordinarily important one. He, to all intents and purposes, should have had an absolutely disastrous relationship with his father, because his father was utterly underwhelmed by Winston. He never thought that he would amount to much. He wrote him extremely angry letters. He seemed desperately ill-tempered when his eldest son came up in conversation. He was horrible about him, both to his face and behind his back. And yet, instead of this turning Churchill off, he, if anything, loved his father all the more. It's a weird thing psychologically. He, after his father died, aged 45, 20, he wrote his father's two-volume biography, a very big book. He wrote, he sought out his father's friends. He tried to really impress his father beyond his father's grave, as it were. He called his own son Randolph. He adopted his father's political stances, the Tory democracy of Benjamin Disraeli, and his physical stance of speaking. And he quoted his father constantly in speeches. And then in 1947, he had a sort of what he called the dream, but seems more like a sort of weird vision, where he met his father's ghost and they talk. And at no point does he let on to his father that he would have been instrumental in winning the Second World War. So you have this this extraordinary relationship with his, in life, extremely caustic father, who was, of course, Chancellor of the Exchequer and successful Victorian politician, mercurial, aloof, disdainful, brilliant man. And Churchill seems to have been profoundly psychologically affected by it ever since, in a positive way that drove him on to try to emulate and ultimately, of course, beat his father.
Which he does over a long career, albeit one that, as you point out, it was not necessarily looked upon with favor by a lot of his contemporaries. I was thinking in particular about your chapter where you're describing his pre-war career as a liberal politician and the contempt with which he was viewed by all of these very prominent people, mostly on the side of the Tories. But you find that even not all the liberals necessarily trusted him.
Well, no, of course. I mean, if you do cross the floor of the House of Commons, not once but twice, it's rather difficult to be trusted by too many people. He wasn't followed by that many people either, and it was therefore an excuse really for people, often less impressive people, to just attack his judgment, full stop. But I found, I think, in the writing of this, and I hope it comes through, that there were principles that he was very much attached to. And actually, it was the parties who moved away from him, especially, of course, over the issue of free trade, rather than him who moved away from the parties, although, of course, he did, as I say, cross the floor of the House. He was slightly mercurial in that sense, rather like his father had been. But he did have these deeply held principles that he stuck to, even if his parties didn't.
I was thinking another reflection of the sense that how the parties were not necessarily fit for him was his belief in the idea of the cross-party coalition. And you write about how that dynamic is reflected in his creation of the Other Club in the years right before World War I, with the idea of that leaders from both sides could come together and hopefully at some point work together in a way that leads to this sensible centrist agenda being achieved without the extremes.
That's
on either
right.
side.
Yes, he's he is in that sense. He's very much in favor of bipartisan politics and finding a sort of new center party which would eschew the ultra nationalism of the right wing Tories and also the neo socialism of the left wing liberals, and would be sort of solidly in the middle. And he thinks, therefore, probably in government forever. But the only drawback is that if you're trying to start a new party, you are very clearly going to be distrusted once the news of this gets out by the people in the original parties, in the parties that do exist. And so that he got all the obloquy and ill temper for that. And at the same time, the other club, which is a magnificent institution and exists to this day, in fact, which he set up in 1911 with his Tory friend F.E. Smith, Lord Birkenhead, and along with his Liberal friend David Lloyd George. And the idea for this was that they were going to, as you say, try to cross party lines and come up with a proper way of governing the nation. And it failed, however successful it was as a club, as a dining club. It failed as an idea, especially as, of course, if anything, party politics became even more rancorous and difficult over issues such as the suffrage and Ireland and the trade unions also in the 3 years or so before the outbreak of the Great War. But it was at least an attempt. And there is a line in the rules of the other club which says that nothing shall interfere with the asperity and rancor of party politics. But in fact, although that is in the club rules, in fact, of course, it was precisely to try to lessen the rancor and asperity of party politics that Churchill set up the club.
That issue of rancor comes up in another respect. You know, I thought of it as you were describing you mentioned particularly the suffragists, because I was fascinated by how you describe his position on the question of women's suffrage in the pre-war period and how he is generally supportive of it. And yet that does nothing to spare him from the criticism and even assaults by suffragists upon him. And he really conveys something about both his ability to have views irrespective of his treatment by the people whom he's dealing with, and also sometimes how you can sense at various points the certain limits that he was reaching in terms of his temper.
Yes, that's right. He had voted in favor of a paving motion for women's suffrage before he started to be attacked by the suffragettes, and I'm afraid as a result, all his combative nature came out very quickly, and he, as you say, he was physically assaulted on a regular basis. People one lady tried to push him under a train, another person horsewhipped him in a train carriage where he was going to make a speech, or at least attempted to horsewhip him. But Churchill was quite a, he could take care of himself as an ex-soldier, and so all in all, it was one of the tragedies really that he did oppose women's suffrage, because it was very bad for him and obviously for his long-term reputation, but he did make these mistakes. You know, Winston Churchill, though he was a genius, he was a deeply flawed genius who constantly made mistakes. He made a mistake, as we mentioned earlier, about the abdication crisis. When Chancellor of the Exchequer put Britain onto the gold standard at the wrong time, at the wrong level. The Dardanelles crisis, I'm sure we'll get onto to discuss later in the podcast, but nonetheless, that also was a catastrophe. There are many more as well. The Black and Tans in Ireland, a good example as well. So he was a politician, though, who learned from his mistakes. And indeed, he said to his wife, Clementine, "I should have made nothing if I had not made mistakes." And I think that's that's an interesting sort of redemptive side of his personality, which and his career, which I think is tremendously important.
I actually want to turn our focus now to the Dardanelles, because up until that point, the controversies that oftentimes plague him, you point out, we misinterpret them. An example being Tony Pandy, which has been misrepresented as the troops being used to suppress miners, when, as you point out, the troops were dispatched, but they were never deployed. They were deployed, but they were never actually involved in dealing with the miners directly. So these contribute to these mythologies about him that are used as criticism. But the Dardanelles is the first time in which his career suffers a very serious reverse as a result of actions in which he's involved. Could you expand a bit upon your presentation of the Dardanelles and how you have fitted in over the course of his life and career?
Well, yes, just to recap about the campaign, it was in the early part of 1915 a completely brilliant strategic concept to get the Royal Navy, of which, of course, he was the political leader in the House of Commons as First Lord of the Admiralty, through the Straits of the Dardanelles from the Mediterranean Sea into just before the Black Sea, and thereby threaten Constantinople, modern-day Istanbul, and effectively knock the Ottoman Empire out of the First World War, basically take Turkey out of the Central Powers. And if it had come off, it would have been one of the great coups of the of World War One. But instead, in the implementation of it, which Churchill, of course, wasn't responsible for, he was back in London, it went disastrously wrong. On the 18th of March 1915, some six ships were sunk in the Dardanelles Straits. And then instead of calling the whole thing off, he insisted that 6 weeks later, a disastrously long gap that allowed the Turks to get ready, although that gap can't be blamed on him either, the troops stormed ashore in the Gallipoli Peninsula on the European side of the Dardanelles Narrows, and there they were held up in conditions just as bad as anything on the Western Front that they were obviously intended to try to obviate. So you have, by the time that they're all evacuated in January 1916, a toll of some 160,000 Allied troops killed and wounded. So, of course, this is a devastating blow to Churchill. He's forced to resign as First Lord of the Admiralty. Then a few months later, when he was of all the war decisions of the cabinet, he resigned altogether and went into the trenches to fight in the First World War. But people still shouted, "What about the Dardanelles?" at him, at his public speeches, all the way through up until the late 1920s. So it was a devastating moment for him. And in fact, he on one occasion even considered suicide.
Wow. So
the things that saved him, sorry, can I just
interrupt?
The two things that saved him from utter despair were, first of all, his wife Clementine, who was tremendously supportive and a wonderful woman. And also, of course, he didn't need to go and fight in the First World War himself, but he became a lieutenant colonel and fought in the front line of the trenches in command of the 6th Battalion of the Royal Scots Fusiliers, in which time he went into no man's land no fewer than 30 times, and extremely brave. He showed the same kind of bravery, physical bravery, as he'd shown many times before in five campaigns on four continents. So you have, therefore, somebody who gets through this terrible black period in his life by fighting, by the support of his wife, and also by painting. He takes up painting at that time, and he says that it's the only thing that is able to take his mind off the pressures of politics and the war.
He does, of course, return to politics, and yet I was going back to something you were talking about a little while ago. There's that sense of resentment, if you will, that some conservatives hold toward him. And I find that's very interesting, considering that given what happens with the Liberal Party in the aftermath of the war, he eventually returns back to that party, that second time crossing the aisle, so to speak. What is it that leads him to do that course of events? And how does he ultimately get embraced back into the Tory fold and resume his career as a conservative?
Well, he was called back in July 1917 to become Minister of Munitions, which is a tremendously important job in the First World War for obvious reasons. And he actually employs some 2.5 million people in the munitions productions factories, and does very well there. He then became Minister of War, and he was in charge of demobilizing the army, which he did very efficiently. And so by 1921, when he is Minister of the Colonies, he is back in the saddle in the Liberal government there of David Lloyd George. But the trouble is, Liberal coalition government. But then the coalition collapses in October 1922, and he's without a seat. He lost his seat. He lost his office. He was outside the cabinet. And as he also points out, he was without an appendix as well, because he had appendicitis at the time that all this was going on. And so he was actually in hospital on the day that the government fell. So from that moment on, in October 1922, he was able to be out of Parliament and able to look again at politics without being subject to the Liberal Party whip. And although he tried on two occasions to get back into Parliament and failed on both occasions, when he finally did get back in, he, by that stage, the Conservatives had come back to the policy of free trade that he'd always been in favour of. So he then crossed the floor of the House again and was made Chancellor of the Exchequer in the Conservative government led by Stanley Baldwin that came into power in 1924.
So he's Chancellor of the Exchequer, 1924. He is a leading member of the government and also of the Conservative Party. And yet, as you described, by the early 1930s, he is in the wilderness. He's in, for many conservatives, a pariah. What happened to bring that about? And why was he, in effect, in the wilderness for as long as he was in the 1930s?
Well, he was when he became Chancellor of the Exchequer in 1924. He stayed as Chancellor throughout that government, the Baldwin government, which took you up to the summer of 1929 when they lost the election. He presented five budgets, which was a lot in those days. He, of course, presided over the very tough government response to the general strike of 1926, which also earned him even more unpopularity with the trade unions, which lasted in many respects for a very long time. And in 1929, when he lost the Tories lost the election, he nonetheless had won his seat this time. And he was able to look at Tory policy in the round again from a sort of objective point of view. And he decided that he could not support the Tories in their support of the Labour Party's proposals to give India what was called dominion status, which meant self-governing status in the same way that Australia, by that stage, Australia, South Africa, New Zealand and Canada were. He didn't believe that would be possible. He thought that there would be disasters, especially up in the Punjab. He thought that the Hindu majority would dominate the Muslim minority. He didn't think that they would be fair to the untouchables or to the Indian princes. And so he opposed it. And this forced him to resign from the shadow cabinet in January 1931 and oppose from the back benches with a small group of about 60 diehard right-wing Tories the policy that was supported by both front benches. So he was onto a losing wicket there and did indeed lose all of the votes for the next 4 years as he was... He wasn't forced into the wilderness. He basically forced himself into the wilderness. And it wasn't over appeasement either. It was over Indian self-government.
You describe this period as one of considerable frustration, and yet he is at the same time trying to rally the country and have them pay attention to what's happening in Germany. How does he do that? And how does that ultimately lead him to return to office at the start of the war?
Well, it was a lonely furrow that he ploughed. Virtually nobody else, no other senior figure in British politics, spotted that the dangers posed by Adolf Hitler and the Nazis, which he did very early on, and he made great use of information that was leaked to him by very brave whistleblowers in the civil service, in the intelligence service, and in the foreign office, three or four individuals who risked their careers by leaking him information, that secret information, that allowed him to piece together what was happening in Germany, i.e., once Adolf Hitler came to power in January 1933, an enormous amount of spending on offensive weapons. This was not just defensive, it was clearly offensive. And Churchill warned the nation. He traipsed up and down the country. He made very impressive speeches in the House of Commons. He accused the governments, three sets of governments, Ramsay MacDonald's, Stanley Baldwin's, and Neville Chamberlain's, of underplaying or even ignoring this clear and present danger to democracy in the West. And unfortunately, because the First World War had been only 20 years earlier, people just simply did not want to listen. They couldn't believe that Hitler and the Nazis would ever start another war after the devastation of the last one. And they thought that Churchill was a warmonger, was exaggerating. He was criticized for using secret information, of course. And people just ridiculed him. They attacked him in the newspapers, of course. But also they tried to deselect him. The Conservative Party tried to deselect him from his seat in order to silence him. And one of the things that makes Churchill an admirable figure, I feel, is the way in which he didn't moderate his message in the way that an awful lot of other politicians might have. Or they might just have shut up altogether. But Churchill didn't. He didn't care about any of that. He had the great moral courage, allied to his physical courage, to continue to make the warnings that he did about the true nature of Nazi Germany.
At the same time, though, he also continues, opposing dominion status for India. He also champions the cause of Edward VIII. And it's interesting how he always sticks by his guns, even in ways that might be counterproductive to his other goals. Whereas had he, you mentioned at various points, he has the opportunity to return to office dangled in front of him. And yet he refuses to compromise his views or his principles in order to achieve that goal.
Well, isn't that the kind of leadership that we're all crying out for? Isn't that something isn't that the reason that I'm hoping people will buy this book and that people are buying this book? I don't think it would be in the bestseller list at the moment if it wasn't an example to everyone that believe what you say, and you keep saying it, however unpopular it makes you. There, he never took any notice of opinion polls. He didn't have a spin doctor. He always wrote all his own speeches. He was a proper leader.
You describe, in your book, you really don't slight any part of Churchill's life, yet you make the focus of your examination the war in his wartime premiership. I was wondering if you could talk a bit about that, and in particular, given the sources that you were able to draw upon, what new insights you're able to bring into understanding Churchill's role as prime minister, his role as Britain's wartime leader, and as leader of the alliance that ultimately triumphs in the war.
Well, yes, you're right. I mean, at least half of the book is about the Second World War. It seems to me that that is the primary importance of Winston Churchill in history, his wartime leadership of Britain in the Second World War. So I think it does justify that amount of space that I give it. He was an inspirational leader, clearly. He was somebody who was able to fight against the demoralization that naturally would have hit Britain in the opening stages of the war when we were flung off the continent at Dunkirk. Although it was a miracle we got the army back, nonetheless, the whole of its heavy weaponry was left destroyed on the beaches of Dunkirk. The men just came back with their rifles, and that was it. And so we then had to face the prospect of possible immediate invasion by the Germans, maybe a parachute invasion in the same way that they'd used parachutists very successfully before. There was a strong pacifist element in Britain that we sometimes forget in those days. There was a fascist, the British Union of Fascists had tens of thousands of members. There were communists who were also opposed to the war. It was a very difficult time, desperately needing, especially during the time that the Germans bombed London, known as the Blitz, and the time when the RAF were fighting the Luftwaffe in the fields, above the fields of southern England, the Battle of Britain. It required tremendous leadership. It required quick decision-making, decisive decision-making, speeches that bolstered the nation, especially at the time of the fall of France, and a clear message that we were going to fight on and not surrender. Even though there were elements in the Foreign Office and elsewhere, especially in the Conservative Party, that wanted to make some kind of peace overtures to Adolf Hitler via Mussolini. And Churchill blocked all of that and made it clear that we were going to fight on in words that really, I think, will resonate in as long as the English tongue is spoken.
We have this, you know, image of him today as being, you know, this great wartime leader. He's very successful. And yet you point out that when you look at his career over the course of the war, that he faced all of these tribulations and difficulties that we've glossed over. One example being, I was particularly struck by how you captured that particularly dark moment in the war in early 1942, even though the United States is involved, where there is no effective naval force in the Far East, or there are no capital ships in the Mediterranean anymore, and how, you know, this is during a time when he faces often, you know, challenges to his leadership, not just from people like Stafford Cripps on the left, but even from people, associates of his, like Lord Beaverbrook.
Yes, that's right. However bad the war got, there were always people who would like to have taken his place and who, frankly, plotted against him. And of course, the more terrible the things that happened, you mentioned early 1942, well, that in February saw the fall of Singapore, and then in June, the fall of Tobruk, and defeats in the North African littoral. So opposition people in Britain, as you say, of all parties, were quite able to point to disasters that had happened. The collapsing of Greece in May 1941 was another example. And to say that what was needed was to get rid of Winston Churchill. However, his personal popularity was actually extraordinarily high, not least because the British people remembered that they understood that one of the reasons for these disasters was that we hadn't been ready for war in 1939, and also that there'd have been only one person warning that we needed to spend more money on defense in the 1930s, and that had been Winston Churchill. So ordinary people in the street gave him an 88, 89, 90, sometimes early 90% opinion poll ratings. They were truly extraordinary numbers that have never been seen before or since in British history, in the history of opinion polling. But in the House of Commons, there were always people who were criticizing him. They criticized him. Even the "We shall fight on the beaches" speech was criticized in the smoking rooms and the tea rooms of the House of Commons by Chamberlainite MPs. As my book demonstrates, he was always had to be on the lookout for people who were attempting to displace him, however much leadership he showed. And the darker the hour it got, the more noisy these people became.
And that was just one political challenge they faced. Another one that you describe is the one in terms of Britain's status in the alliance with the Soviet Union and the United States. I was thinking in particular about your section on Tehran, where he, when he has to worry about whether or not Britain is going to be, in effect, shuffled out might be too dramatic way of putting it, but in effect that he, that the British might be sidelined as the Soviets and Americans might very well come together and treat the British as sort of the junior partner, even though they've been fighting the war longer than either one of them.
Well, that's right. And in fact, of course, it was partly because we had fought the war, Britain had fought the war longer than either one of them, that they were in a weaker position by the time 1943, the Tehran conference that you mentioned, comes about in the November of that year. By which time, yes, Churchill had sort of spotted that in the post-war world, there was only going to be space for two superpowers, and it looked very much like Britain wasn't going to be one of them. And he felt some resentment at this, but nonetheless, there was very little he could have done about it. By the calendar year 1944, when Britain produced 28,000 warplanes and the Russians and Germans both produced 40,000, the United States produced 94,000 warplanes. So it was quite clear that the US was going to be one of the two superpowers, and there was very little really that Churchill could do at a time of a shrinking empire and a and having far fewer men vis-a-vis the Americans when it came to things like Operation Overlord, the D-Day attacks. But he did resent this. You know, he could never say so publicly, but it's clear from what he said to the King in their meetings and also to his private secretary, Jock Colville, that, that Churchill did resent the inevitable fact that after the war, British power was going to be eclipsed.
You quote this... You quote Churchill in this conversation that he has with Anthony Eden, where he talks about how he's uninterested in a lot of the issues that Britain is going to be facing in peacetime. And yet after the war, he stays on as Conservative Party leader for another decade. And he also returns as Prime Minister in 1951 and serves another 4 years in that position. Why did he decide to hold on, and what were some of the challenges that he faced during this period, both as opposition leader and then later on as prime minister?
Well, the key factor was, I suppose, A, that he's a fighter, and Churchill was not going to give up. The second thing, of course, was that he hadn't won a general election as prime minister. He had become prime minister as a result of the fall of Neville Chamberlain, but he hadn't ever actually won an election. He'd only fought one election, and that was in July 1945, and he'd lost it. So he wanted to carry on and to be returned by the will of the people, which, of course, did happen in April 1951, by which time he was in his late 70s, and probably, although he was not a bad peacetime premier, he wasn't a very good one either, and he missed any series of opportunities to resign. He could have resigned on his 80th birthday, he could have resigned at the time of the Queen's coronation, he could have resigned when he had a stroke, a debilitating stroke in 1953, but on each occasion he passed up these perfect opportunities, and poor Anthony Eden had to wait, as you say, for an entire 10 years after the Second World War, before he himself became Prime Minister.
I had to think about it when you described how, you know, in some ways it didn't matter in the end because, you know, Eden would not necessarily have responded any differently to a lot of the issues that Churchill faced during his second premiership. And yet, you know, when Eden does get the reins, he doesn't survive more than 2 years before he has to leave office himself.
That's right. Well, the Suez Crisis wasn't anything that people could really have predicted in 1954, 1955 even. It was a sudden nationalization of the Suez Canal by President Nasser of Egypt that suddenly threw Eden into a situation that I think even Churchill would have found tremendously difficult to have dealt with successfully, not least because the Americans were no longer on the side of the old colonial powers. They wanted to forge ahead with their own relations with the young Arab nationalist powers. So in a way, Churchill was quite lucky, really, that he did resign in time. It's difficult to know how he could have dealt with that situation any differently from Eden.
You have now written this massive work on Churchill that is, you know, goes into his life in great detail, reflecting the years that you've spent going through his papers, assessing various aspects of his life. At this point, what is it that you've taken away from it about Winston Churchill? And what is it also you're hoping that readers take away from it about Winston Churchill?
I think I'd like readers to take away a series of ideas, really. One of them is the concept of this man's extraordinary physical and moral courage. Also, his ability to work out sentences and phrases and paragraphs that are clear and beautifully written and able to go straight to the heart of an issue. And on top of that, his ability as a politician to learn from his mistakes. And on top of all of those things, his foresight, not just before the Second World War, as we've spoken about, but also before after the Second World War, at the time of the Iron Curtain speech in March 1946 in Fulton, Missouri, where he warned the world about Stalin and Soviet communism and was attacked for that as well. So you have all of these things coming together in a politician who was a flawed genius, who made lots of mistakes but learned from them.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
I'm thinking, I've got a couple of ideas about what to write next. Usually I've already started writing the next book by the time I'm still publicizing the last one. This time it's very difficult because following Napoleon, which was my book before Churchill, and now Churchill, it's terribly difficult to think of a person who's a subject who's going to engage me to anything like the degree that those two great behemoths did. But if any of your listeners have any ideas for what I should write about next, I'd be very interested in entertaining them.
Well, I'm sure whatever it is you choose, it ultimately will be a book just as interesting as your Churchill biography, which I hope, given as you were alluding to at the very end, what we've talked about over the past several minutes has only just scratched the surface of this book that really examines so many different aspects of his life.
Thank you very much indeed for giving me such a long time to talk about a subject I love. I really appreciate it, Mark.
Well, you're very welcome, and I hope you have a wonderful day.
Thank you.